Hi, and welcome to the Atheist Podcast. If you want to have an open and honest discussion where your opinion will not be judged, you've come to the right place. I'm Jonathan Tindall, and we will be discussing beliefs, non-beliefs, and questions dealing with religions. My co-hosts are George, John, and our intrepid producer, Robert, and we are the Atheist Podcast.
Hello, this is the Atheist Podcast. My name is Jonathan Tindall. I have George and John on the line, or on the call with us, and we have Robert, our producer, in the background. So how's everyone doing?
I'm doing great.
Good?
Okay, well, since this is our first podcast, let's do some introductions. Who wants to go first? How about you, John? What's your background?
Well, I grew up in a fairly non-religious household. I mean, if I was to say so, it was there was no mention of religion. It was neither for nor against. It was just absent. And that's how I grew up in my mother's house. My parents were divorced early, so I lived with my mother till I was 10. Then I moved in with my father, who, you know, also was not religious. We went to church, I don't know, like on the big ones, Easter, Christmas, but that was about it. No mention of God. When I was about 22, 23 years old, I would say that's when I became a Christian. It was only after discussing things with some coworkers, one of which was a pastor at a local church, and I'd say that's where I've stayed. I consider myself a conservative religiously, conservative politically, you know, but I love the discussion. I love the debate, the arguments. I've got an opinion on just everything too, so I'm easy going. I have an opinion on everything.
Well, how did you come about and I know apologist is a ugly word, but how did you come about, you know, becoming an actual apologist to, again, not to be rude saying it?
No, well, my the particular coworker that I'm talking about, I had initially, when I found out that he was a pastor, I did what most atheists who would come to my my blog would do, is they'd throw challenges out there at me. So I would throw some stuff out at him, trying to stumble him up, and his answers, you know, he gave me answers that sounded like he looked something up, you know what I mean? He didn't say, well, the Bible says I believe it, case closed. You know, he said, well, go look this up, go check this out, and come back and tell me what you think. So I think that's one of the reasons I had become a Christian, is because before I had formed any solid religious conviction, I spent a lot of time looking into the claims that everybody was making. So as I listened to the Christian apologists and the Muslim apologists and the Mormon apologists and so on, I found more credibility and more solid answers and substance from the Christian apologists. And I think that's what steered me that way. And I just enjoyed the fact that there was some history behind it.
And I actually applaud you for actually going and looking for your own answers. One of the things that always irritated me was, like you're saying, you know, your coworker that's a Christian, or, you know, that vague Christian type person. Whenever you when you pose them a question, they say, well, let me ask my pastor. Well, I'm not asking your pastor. If I wanted to ask your pastor something, I would ask your pastor. I'm looking to you. You know, what is your belief? That's irritating.
And you know, that's just another thing about me, is I have a thing where if I don't know the answer to something, I like to find out the answer, regardless of the subject. I don't like to not know. So when somebody asks me a question, if I don't have an opinion or I don't know, I don't mind saying, you know what, I'm not really sure, but I will get back to you. And then I will go look it up. I will go, you know, I check from both angles. You know, a cousin of mine, just the other day, we were having a discussion, and he's, whatever it is we were talking about, I says, you know what might serve you better in the conversation is when you're done looking your thing up or watching your YouTube video, search that and then debunked. so you could see what both sides of that issue are saying, and then you need to make a better informed decision once you know where everybody on each side is coming from. And I really enjoy that on really any issue, whether it's political, religious, social, any of those.
I personally don't like the word debunk. Inform is better to me. But debunking means a negative thing. You can never prove a negative. So, we got a little bit of background on you. Hey, George, how about you? How'd you come to be here? Other than your mom and dad met each other one day.
Yeah, that's a long story that I won't go into, mom and dad one. I grew up in a fairly religious family. I went to church very regularly until my parents bought a small business, made going to church impossible. And the funny thing about that is that actually drew a little bit of religious fervor out of me. Not going to church made me pick up my dad's Bible. My dad had a Bible that was given to him by his mom, gave it to me to go through. I started picking it up on my own, got proactive, started going to a youth group, ended up a little bit later joining another youth group with a friend of mine in high school. It was an evangelical youth group, got really involved with the evangelical church for a couple years, became a youth pastor for a while, but really that descent or ascent or however you want to call it into atheism was a slow process. It certainly didn't happen overnight. Started off kind of just not getting as involved. But still being a very strong believer. Then I was challenged by a friend of mine who's a very, very ardent Christian on evolution. And that started that whole process for me. Got the ball rolling. But it took 2.5-3 years.
So whenever you read through the Bible the first time, and I know, you know, we've talked in privately, we've talked and you've read through the Bible. What about that, the first time you read through it, what was off then?
I don't know that the Bible was off for me. I mean, there was a lot of things about it that I really loved. But I think a lot of what got me starting to challenge my faith and starting to question it was some things where there's a contradiction in the Bible, sure, but as a Christian, I think you get workarounds for those. And there's always people willing to tell you, well, that's not exactly a contradiction. Part of it was cultural. You know, there are certain things in the Bible that don't jive with what I see out in the real world, and that made me or spurned me on to challenge the Bible even more and say, well, if the Bible, either I'm wrong or the Bible's wrong, or we're both wrong. I mean, really, both of us can be wrong. But something's got to give here, right? I've either got to find a way to work the Bible to what I believe is true and real and happening in the real world, or I've got to just dump it all together. And that was a process for me.
Well, that actually leads me to an interesting question. Do you consider yourself an atheist or an agnostic?
When I get asked this question, I think the answer I give most often is I'm an atheist when it comes to specific religions. I consider myself an agnostic when it comes to a general idea of a God. I can't argue that there might be some vague prime mover God out there that really created the universe and then hasn't done much since. And I'm agnostic towards that principle. I don't believe it. I lean towards the, no, that's not the way it is. but I don't have enough evidence to say clearly that's false. When it comes to Christianity, I'm an atheist. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And that's the same thing with Islam. It's the same thing with every faith I've taken the time to learn a lot about. I know a lot about Islam. My brother is married to a Muslim. I spent a lot of time learning about and researching that religion as the marriage got closer. I know a lot about a lot of the Eastern faiths. So any of the ones I've researched, I'm definitely an atheist about.
Okay. Well, I guess it's weird for me to say. It's my turn to say something about myself. Both of you are welcome to ask me questions, just like I was doing to you. I grew up in a vaguely Southern Baptist home. My grandmother was actually very strongly religious, and they drug me to church on Sundays and went to Sunday school and that kind of stuff. It just never clicked with me. You know, I just never, what's the terminology, never felt the spirit, if you will. It just never clicked with me. Once I got out of the house and actually got out on my own, then it really strongly didn't click with me because I wasn't in that culture anymore. To this day, the last time I stepped in a church was at my grandmother's funeral. Didn't burst into flames. The heavens didn't open up. The ground didn't try to swallow me whole or anything like that. I am just... I'm just a non-believer. I can't even really strongly identify with an atheist, with the atheist opinion, because I don't know. I've never really felt whatever people feel or are supposed to feel about religion.
Do you think that that would be important to you to feel something? I mean, for example, I don't necessarily... have some overwhelming feeling, you know, like some Christians might describe being in the spirit or anything like that. So in your opinion, do you think that not having that feeling influences what you believe? In other words, do you think you should have that feeling, or is that something that you can just intellectually get to?
I don't think I can intellectually get to it, to be honest. When it comes to the feeling, I know the feeling of love. I have a wife. I have three kids. And I know that I love them. And I know whenever they look at me that they love me. So if there was a deity of any sorts, I should be able to feel that. So I don't really, like I said, I just don't know. I do identify as an atheist, but that's just per category. You know, the categories.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is because I don't have that overwhelming feeling, but I do know that a lot of people do, and they place a lot of stock in that. So I was just wondering for you if that was important to have that feeling.
Oh yeah, like I said, I would have to have that feeling. You know, if I didn't have that overwhelming sense, like whenever I look into my wife or my kids' eyes, of I love this person. Yeah, I don't think I could. I honestly don't think I could believe in anything like that.
Well, and interject a little bit on this point. When I was a Christian, when I was part of the church, I did have a lot of those feelings. You know, and now looking back on it, I kind of write that off as, you know, euphoria. When you're in a church, when there's a specifically great song or a specifically great sermon, or you're with other religious people and you have, there is a sense of euphoria that sort of comes around you. And I think as people, if we want to enough, we can sort of, some of us, I guess not all, because, you know, I can't generalize for everybody, but I think some of us can summon that. And I think even as an atheist today, I can summon. I can summon that. I can summon a feeling of awe of something beyond myself. I can, you know, walk outside at night and look up at the moon and the stars and the trees and the wind softly blowing through the leaves and feel something bigger than me. But I don't, as an atheist, obviously, you know, ascribe that to a religious experience. I think that's us as people searching and trying to find it. And I think if you believe it enough, if you want to feel that euphoria enough, you'll feel it, you know. But some people just maybe can't do that.
Yeah, and I think that's where I differ with a lot of Christian and religious people, is that, you know, feelings can be manipulated, just like you said, through music, through group, you know, everybody's having this experience, you're going to start feeling it too. And I don't think that that's a reliable way of determining what's true and what's false. I mean, you know, how many Red Sox fans or Yankees fans or whoever out there think their team is the best team, you know, but they all have that feeling of camaraderie when they're out there. They have that energy. They have all this stuff. But I don't know. Maybe that's a bad example, but I don't think that associating a feeling with something that's true or false is very reliable. And maybe that's why I've never done it. I don't know.
I actually would like to challenge both of you that every phenomenon that you, George, said and you, John, said can be explained through body chemistry. I mean, we can actually induce these things in people. So whenever we're talking about feelings in the first place, that's subjective because, you know, like I said, we can induce that in people. I mean, we can do that, we can't, but scientists can. How do you justify that? And I'm actually asking both of you.
Can I go first, John? Because I'm I'll let you finish. But well, the way I see it, like as an atheist, as I said, I mean, I ascribe those feelings, obviously, not to a religious experience. I don't ascribe them religiously. I do look at it very much from a scientific perspective. From that perspective, that when I was 12 and I was walking with my friends down a dark road at 11:30 at night, and, you know, there was a rustle in the bush, we were terrified. We were, you know, there were boogeymen in the bush. I mean, that's a feeling. It's a feeling that overwhelms you, even though it's irrational. And I, from that point of view, I think scientifically we can say, you know, 8-year-olds think there are monsters under their beds. It's obviously false that that's the case, but they're convinced that that's fact. You know, people who are religious, who have religious experiences, Muslims have as much of a religious experience as Christians do. Hindus have equally big religious experiences. So they can't all be right. I mean, they can't all be having a religious experience. Maybe they can. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But to further that point, I think, you know, and I think John's going to say this as well, that talking about feelings as a proof of a higher power is really pointless, because you're really talking about something very much inside of you. And I think unless we can, you know, come to a conclusion logically and rationally and argue through it, and that's one of the things that I respect about John, that he does argue for a higher power. He doesn't say, well, you know, I felt the warm tinglies at church this weekend, therefore God. He does try to logically argue that position. And I think when we're trying to talk about God, we're trying to argue about God or have a conversation about God, I think we need to not, as much as possible, appeal to emotion. And John, I'll let you interject from there.
Yeah, I would say that sure, we can induce that feeling. You know, people's feelings can be manipulated, but I don't think that just because we know that's the case that you can dismiss everybody's experience through something like that, because God certainly could give you that spirit and that energy. You know, whether he happens to be doing that to any one particular person at that particular time is left to be seen. But I think more importantly is that the Bible doesn't seem to teach that we should expect that. If you read through, you know, Peter and Paul, their experiences, and even those in the Old Testament, they don't have these feelings where people have their hands up to the sky and they're falling down and they're shaking around on the ground and that they're being overwhelmed to the point where they're in tears. You don't see that. What you do is you have people say, God said this, he he's demonstrating it through this particular supernatural event, therefore believe it. You know, Paul's biggest evangelistic tool was repent and believe. Jesus said, you know, sure, you don't believe, you know, what I'm saying, believe what I'm doing. And nobody ever said to look for a feeling or to expect a feeling or to judge whether or not Jesus is who he said he was based on some feeling you have. And that is one place where I think a lot of the evangelical churches get it wrong, is they teach you to expect these feelings, even if it's not explicit, but the congregation will have these feelings. And so you have people who come in like Jonathan from the outside, and then now they don't have this feeling. There's two conclusions: either God doesn't love me or God isn't there, otherwise I'd have these feelings. And that's where I think the biggest mistake of the church is to teach people to be looking for these feelings.
Well, then, and I actually have a question for George after that. Then how does one go about logicking, you know, I don't even know the words I want to use. How do you logically work yourself into being a Christian?
Well, I think you ask the questions. Does God exist? Okay, well, if God exists, let me see if I could find a reason why God might exist. You know, I mean, I think a lot of the philosophical arguments are pretty solid. Most people, I think, will tell you that you can't argue somebody into the kingdom. I don't know if you've ever heard anybody say that, but I hear it all the time. Some people will say that, oh, well, what makes you think that you can love them into the kingdom if you can't argue them into the kingdom? And I think people can't. You know, it depends on what you're looking for. It depends on the questions you ask and where you go looking for your answers. If you go looking to somebody who's going to tell you just read it and believe, otherwise, you know, you're a heathen, I don't think you're going to get there. But if you ask somebody and they say, well, you know, have you tried looking here and asking, you know, I don't necessarily know how to elaborate more, but I think it's the questions you ask yourself and where you look for the answers is where you end up coming through with the answer.
Okay. George, this is my question I had for you. You were mentioning about the kids being scared and the rustling in the bushes. Do you believe in evolutionary selection? Is that why you're saying that, or is there something else that goes along with that?
Well, I think definitely that feeling of fright is definitely an evolutionary, it's a definite example of evolution in action. I mean, as humans, we did have to be very aware of things that we maybe couldn't see but could hear or could sense. We had to be very, you know, sensory about these things. And I think that comes down to, you know, why children are afraid of the dark, why children let their imaginations run wild, because I think from an evolutionary perspective, that imagination, that idea, that ability to, you know, think about what could be, was helpful more than hurtful most times. You know, I think most people, if there was a lion stopping you up in the bush, you heard one little branch break, being startled by that and being frightened by that, even though you didn't know it was a lion. You don't know if it's a lion or if it's a hedgehog. You have no idea. Obviously, if it's a hedgehog, no big deal. But if it's a lion, that's a scary perspective, right? So I think, you know, that scared feeling certainly is an evolutionary thing. But I think, too, a lot of the feelings we have about, you know, God and a higher power are evolutionary shortcuts. I mean, they make it easy for us to, you know, in one sense, I think that a lot of what we believe and the reason why culture after culture, no matter where you go in the world, how far away they are from each other, how much they've never interacted with each other, all of them generally have a religion, is because as humans, we're inquisitive. We want to know answers. And if there is a simple shortcut, a religion, whether it be, you know, a Roman or Greek religion, or whether it's Norman religion, whether it's Christianity, whether it's Islam, that answers those those questions for people and allows them to kind of move on with their life and do other things. So you're not sitting down on your couch all day going, how did I get here? Why is this way? How are humans created? How is the world created? It's a shortcut. It allows us to answer that question and move on.
And what do you think, John? Do you have any response to that?
I don't know. You know, that's never been convincing to me that religion was started because, you know, people had questions they couldn't answer. I mean, I think explain that and to some of the rudimentary, maybe Aboriginal religions where, you know, they might pray to the sun and then to the volcano and then to the desert and then to the lake, things like that. I would say those are the superstitious based religions. But when you start getting into the complex faiths such as Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the three revelatory religions, I don't find a basis in the text somewhere where it says, well, I couldn't explain this, therefore, you know, God. They don't seem to be based in that. You know, and again, I think everybody's presuppositions definitely color how we come to certain conclusions. For example, George mentioned that, you know, every culture has its own religion, has its own God, has its own practice. But that, if you're going to chalk that up to, well, they just don't know what it is, I think that sort of presupposes that God doesn't exist. You know, I mean, couldn't that also be explained by maybe God does exist and it's been revealed culture after culture, or man's innate knowledge that God does exist?
One of the things that you just were mentioning was monotheism and polytheism. How, and this kind of struck me as odd, how can you say that monotheism is more complex than polytheism?
Well, I wasn't necessarily making that statement. I was trying to compare what I would call superstitious or Aboriginal religious systems where somebody needs the corn to grow, so they go pray to something that might make the corn grow. And if the corn doesn't grow, then maybe they just need to do it a little bit harder and now offer something a little bit different. What I was making that comparison as opposed to religions that would claim revelation. The big three, anyway, they claim that they were communicated to directly by the one God that they happen to be centered around. That was really the comparison that I was making. And I would call that more complex because there's doctrine and theology mixed in as opposed to some formula, you know, do this to get this result, almost like a genie.
Like magic. You know,
right. A lot of those very base religions, they're basically appealing to a genie, you know, as well. Or, just like magic. If I do this in the right order, then I will get this result. And so that's why I made that comparison.
Okay. I'm going to scope back just a little bit. And actually, George, you were the one that made me think about this. Imagination. I actually think that is the one true thing that humans have that have made us what we are. Is we can imagine. You know, we can imagine what tomorrow is going to be like. And we can imagine things that are true. And we can imagine things that are not true. If there was a deity, and this is a question to both of you, wouldn't you think that is the one greatest gift that it gave us? I'm not going to say he or she, but it gave us. Whoever wants to jump in first.
Well, I'll jump in first. I would say if there is a God, absolutely imagination is a big thing for us as animals. From a human perspective, I think it's part of what makes us uniquely human. From an evolutionary perspective, I think it's part of what sets us apart and allows us to do things that other animals can't do. I mean, imagination is what allows us to look at a problem and imagine possible outcomes before solution. Imagination allows us to understand cause and effect. But at the same time, to kind of roll that back to the last point, imagination also what gives us a feeling that everything that happens happens for a reason. You know, that imagination that A happens because of B happens because of C. Important idea that if I pray to God for rain, I will get rain, and if I don't get rain, it's because God's not happy. You know, and to come back to John a little bit on that, that's not an uncommon feeling among Christians. I mean, a lot of Christians pray to God for you know, the Supreme Court to come on their side on homosexuality. When it doesn't happen, he's going to smite us. I mean, there's this process of A happens because of B happens because of C, that somehow God has, and Christians have said this, God has abandoned America because of the evil that it does, right? I mean, that is exactly the same as I pray for corn, I get it, or I don't. But that's, again, that's imagination, and that's where it all ties back.
John?
Well, I don't know. I think imagination definitely makes us unique, and I would say that's actually exactly what we should expect if God did exist. God bestowed upon us, you know, we're image bearers, so to speak. We inherited a lot of those qualities, the imagination, the ability to think, the ability to reason, the ability to create things like that. You know, we don't really see anything beyond survival. I mean, I'm sure you could come up with a few examples, but you know, beyond survival, I don't think you see a lot of imagination in the animal species, and I don't think that you would expect to if God did not exist. I don't think you should expect to find that in us. I mean, you know, beyond saying that the universe was built for us, I think it's hard to explain how advanced just this one particular species would advance as such. For me, it's a little beyond what I'm willing to accept. And that's that there.
When it comes to imagination, even like I was saying before, even if there is a deity, or if it's just evolution, that is the greatest gift that humanity was given. I mean, it doesn't need to be anything other than just that's the greatest gift. All right, gentlemen, I'd like to go ahead and we'll transition to news. Anyone want to go first? I mean, I've got mine. Mine's going to be a physics thing. I was reading something on phys.org the other day. Have any of you actually heard of the Torus model of the universe?
No.
No?
I'm not familiar with it.
It's possible that I've heard of it.
It's actually pretty interesting.
It might be something I've heard of.
A more common, what would be more common, like a donut. You can just imagine Homer Simpson reaching down from the great ether and just taking a big bite out of a donut. Essentially what it says is the universe is shaped like a donut. It's got a hole in the center, which we can't experience because that's out of three dimensions or four dimensions. But no matter what you do, you can't reach one edge or the other. Does that make any sense?
Well, I mean, I guess if you're looking for speculation, I find that a lot of the models that go beyond what evidence we actually do have for the initial the singularity. You know, when you start digging into, well, we can't really see this, but you know, we kind of hope or think that it's there. I think you're really, really on a stretch trying to figure out a way to create a universe without a creator.
Oh, no, this has nothing to do. This, honestly, is just a straight physics thing. This has really nothing to do with the singularity or anything else.
No, I understand that, but that's what I'm saying is the evidence for it what it sounds like, and again, I haven't read it, but where it seemed like you were starting was it's a speculative idea, and generally those are put out there, like the multiverse is put out there to avoid an overall beginning of the universe.
Oh well, no, that's completely understandable. Again, like I said, I wasn't trying to. That particular article really, I mean, you could say that God made it into a Taurus. I'm not disputing that at this particular moment, but it's just weird the way that I understand it, which I know my spatial imagining is a lot different than a lot of other people. You can never reach a border in the Taurus model of the universe, because no matter what you do, you're always going to come back to where you began. No matter what direction, no matter what speed, you will always come back eventually to where you began. And it's always... What's that?
I'm sorry, on what basis did they come to that conclusion?
Oh, well, like all... I know what you're trying to get to. Like all theoretical physics, it's all speculation in the first place. I just don't think that, you know, that kind of explains why no matter where you look, everything looks exactly the same. We look like we are in the center of the universe. No matter where you look, no matter how you look, it looks that way. And it looks like that whether we're here, whether we're in Alpha Centauri or wherever, we always look, you in your particular frame of reference, you look like you're in the center of the universe.
I thought you said you based views on evidence alone. What did I miss?
Just to give my little bit, again, I don't understand much about it, but I love physics. I love hearing about physics. I love seeing what physicists are saying now. But the way it's being explained to me at this moment, you know, just sounds like it's rife for some new agey person to hijack it and turn it into crazy woo. Because, again, this whole you're always in the center of the universe thing, a lot of these things, they just scream out, you know, and it doesn't matter what physicists say. Every time they say anything, somebody out there turns it into weird woo juice.
I never said that you are always in the center of the universe. I said that it always seems to you in your particular
frame of reference. Jonathan, that is the conversation that a physicist is going to be having with one of those people. He's going to say, I'm not saying we're in the center of the universe. It's just, it seems like we are. You know, even when we get outside of physics or to the edges of physics, when we talk about you know, the concept of the world made for mankind, the universe made for mankind, the anthropomorphic principle. It gets totally twisted outside of talking about it from a science perspective. The anthropic principle is useful to physicists outside of that, and if you even have ever read about it, the scientist who coined the name for it says, I wish I hadn't have called it that. Because it's more than that, and it's a lot more, there's a lot more to it than what the name suggests.
And let's not forget that the Big Bang Theory was actually thought up by a Jesuit priest. I mean,
well,
true as well.
Yeah, and let's note that that bit of science came from a religious person, just for the record. I just wanted to get that on there for everybody. That's my contribution.
I gave a hat tip. So who's next up for news? Who wants to do the next one?
Okay. So my turn for a new story. I want to talk to John a little bit about how he feels about the Satanic Monument going up in Detroit. And we've seen this a lot. I mean, the Satanic Church is an organization that has really used religious laws and sort of subverted them to put the issue. How do you feel about that, John, Satanic Monument going up in Detroit?
No, well, I think that when the country was founded and what's the word I'm trying to think of, it really was founded with a particular purpose. I think that Christianity and Christians were intended to influence the government, and if you read some of the earliest Supreme Court decisions, the First Amendment wasn't really put out there to countenance something like Satanism or any sort of satanic or any just any old religion. I mean, granted, that's how it's been interpreted, that's how it's being applied today, but it's honestly, it's an antagonistic thing towards Christians. I have a hard time believing Satanists are really clamoring for some sort of public display. It's really one of those things just to stick it to the man, so to speak, and you throw that out there. It's like, oh well, if you want your creche on the lawn of the town hall at Christmas time, you better put our goat up so we can hate God. I think it's in poor taste. I don't think that's the way the First Amendment was put out there to protect. Now, if they want to do that, then be my guest. But I really think it's a non-issue.
Jonathan, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I know it's antagonistic. That's what it's supposed to be. You were saying that that's the way that the law has been interpreted. But whenever it's interpreted as law, it's actual law. And this is the law, if you allow one religion, you have to allow them all. So if I want to put up a Baphomet statue, guess what? It's the law.
That's actually not the law. That's not written into that local law, and it's also not written into the Constitution. That's an interpretation of what's actually written.
I think that the Supreme Court would disagree with you.
They may very well, but they also disagreed with the Obama administration, who said, yes, Obamacare is a tax, and then they came back and said, no, it's not. So just because it's written in laws, you know, just because the Supreme Court decides to interpret something that way, that doesn't mean that's the law and that's what was written. There's a reason that the Supreme Court issues opinions and not laws. They're reading it, they try to figure out what they think it means, but there is no law that says if you allow one, you allow all. What it says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion. Which
politicians framed the Constitution in such a way and have framed the issue as freedom of religion. And you're absolutely right, at some point when it was written down on paper, they may have been thinking freedom to practice whatever kind of Christianity you want to practice. But the reality is we live in a pluralistic society, and the court has decided, and we as a society have decided, that all religions should have equal chance to express themselves in our cultures. So the reason why the Satanic Church is taking this up, I think you're right. It's absolutely antagonistic. It's absolutely meant to make Christians angry. But they're in a unique position to do that. They're in a position where they want to take that issue up. They want to take that mantle up. And as atheists, we can't really take that mantle up because there are no atheist statues that I can put up. I mean, as much as Christians would like to think that I really want a Charles Dawkins statue up on a lawn, that's you know, or Charles Darwin, Richard Dawkins, like whatever it is, I don't want those things. I can't have those things, and those aren't religious iconography. The Satanic Church has religious iconography, and they're pushing the issue. I think good on them, because I think it's going to force some Christians to think about religious freedom and about their freedoms versus the freedoms of everybody else.
Well, I'd actually, and I'm going to try to keep as neutral as possible, but I'll ask you, well, I already know what you're probably going to say, George. Say that a Muslim wants to celebrate Ramadan on state property. Would you have an issue with that?
I don't know that I would if we're going to be extending that to Christians, if we're going to be extending that to Jews, if we're going to be extending that to other religions, that is the purpose of public property, is to accommodate religious services and religious rituals, then I'm fine with it. But the rule has to be equal. All I think anyone's saying here is that if we allow Christian prayer at City Hall meetings, we have to allow imams to have a prayer at City Hall meeting. If we're going to allow public property to be used for religious purposes, it has to be equitable, it has to be fair.
Okay, so you agree that the Satanist church should be able to put up their thing?
I absolutely agree they should be able to.
Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Well, gentlemen, I know we've been at this for almost an hour now. Not a bad go at it for our first podcast. What would you say?
I'd say it's a little rough. Obviously, the format's going to get it's going to smooth itself out. I think once we nail down our topics and we get things where they're supposed to be, I think we'll be all right.
Okay, George.
I had fun with the conversation. Anytime I get to sit down for an hour and talk about topics like this is a good hour in my book. So always happy when I get to do this kind of stuff.
Well, I had a blast myself. I like moderating a little bit. I need to work on being a little bit more neutral. I have my own views, so sometimes that's fairly hard. But I actually enjoyed myself and really, really had a lot of fun. So for any of the listeners, if we ever get any, there you go. This is the Atheist Podcast. I'm Jonathan. There's George. There's John. And our intrepid producer, Robert, is in the background just shaking his head. And there you go.
Thank you for listening to the Atheist Podcast, a production of Rationality Unleashed Media, rationalityunleashed.net, or you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/rationalityunleashed.